Well, welcome again. Let's get underway with our first full panel of the morning. Again, I'm Steve Smith from the Wiedenbaum Center at Washington University, former senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution. My partner in organizing today's program is Sarah Binder, senior fellow at Brookings, and a co-author with me of a Brookings book back in 1997 on the history of the filibuster. The topic tends to come back into the forefront every now and then, so we keep plenty busy on it. It's a great pleasure to have you all here. You know, my first filibuster experience was in 1973 when I was a Senate doorman. Then Senator Walter Mondale allocated some of his patronage positions, which don't really exist anymore, at least not in the same form, to a couple of his interns, and one of those positions was Senate doorman. So I got to take a tour of duty manning the doors. And if you don't know, the doormen have to be on duty whenever the Senate is in session. And Jim Allen from Alabama decided to filibuster Gail McGee's postcard registration bill in the spring of 1973, which meant that we got to stay on duty. My attitude about the filibuster was imprinted on me and hasn't changed much since, I'm afraid to report. But we, in this panel, we have really an exceptional group of people with a wealth of knowledge about Senate practice, and it's my pleasure to introduce them. Richard Baker is on my far right. Dick is historian emeritus of the Senate. He was the first historian of the United States Senate, serving through this past August. He directed the office, the historical office, from its creation back in 1975, PhD in history. And among many of his activities today, he's putting the finishing touches on a history of Senate procedure that all of us scholars of the Senate are eager to see. Next is Robert Dove. Bob is parliamentarian emeritus. He served for 36 years in the Senate. Since his retirement back in 2001, he served as counsel to Patton Boggs, as the congressional chair at GW's Graduate School of Political Management, and has served as an adjunct at Georgetown University's Law Center. He's a senior fellow and adjunct professor there. PhD from Duke and a JD from Georgetown. He didn't have enough to do, I guess, as Senate parliamentarian, so he picked up a few degrees along the way. And last but not least, Martin Paoni. Marty has a depth of experience on the Senate floor that really no one living, with the exception maybe of Bob Byrd, can match. He was in the Democratic cloakroom beginning in 1979, became a floor staffer for the Democratic Policy Committee, which back in those days was directed by the floor leader directly, from 82 to 91, and assistant secretary for the majority in 91-94. Since that time, he's been his party's floor secretary in both majority and minority status, which meant that really no one's been on the floor more than Marty in the last generation. There really are a few other people with the inside perspective of Marty. It is a special pleasure to have him here. He's now executive vice president of the Prime Policy Group and a visiting professor in the D.C. program of the College of William & Mary, where they have some very lucky students to have Marty as an instructor each year. Our panelists are each going to spend about 10 minutes with their overview of the state of the Senate, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers. Let's begin with Dick down at the end.
Strengths and weaknesses of the Senate. And so I chose three strengths and three weaknesses. Each one could be the subject of a separate conference. Of course, there are many, many others, but you know, you have to put your oar in and go. But I'd like to begin by noting that 86 years ago, a Massachusetts senator named David Walsh described a fundamental strength of the Senate. His description deserves a place on any list of today's Senate strengths. Walsh said that the Senate is the last citadel of minority rights and the protector of weaker states. He continued, in an age when executive authority is expanding tremendously, he was writing this during the Calvin Coolidge administration, the Senate is the only safeguard against executive usurpation and tyranny. Jumping ahead to 1956, Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson offered his own definition of the Senate. He had those words inscribed on the pediment of the newly constructed Dirksen Senate Office Building. This is as close as you're going to get to a Senate motto. In Johnson's simple words, the Senate is the living symbol of our union of states. Today, this living symbol reflects, for better or for worse, the political landscape of those red, blue, baby blue, and pink states. So here, getting into my list of strengths. And, of course, none of these strengths is an unmixed blessing, for sure. In fact, they could be on the weakness list just as easily. And we start with the Constitution's framers, of course. What did they mean? What did they think? They didn't anticipate there would be political parties, so their batting record is not terribly good in terms of thinking ahead. But they did their best, and they did very well. And in designing today's Senate, they created, as we all know, a deliberately malapportioned legislature. If the U.S. Senate were a state Senate, it would be declared unconstitutional because of its structure. Today, 50% of the nation's population, as we all understand in this room, 50% lives in 10 states and is accordingly represented by just 20 senators. The other 50% of the nation's population lives in the 40 smaller states and gets 80 senators. So the Senate is about as far from a rule-by-majority institution as you could get. The tradition of filibusters conducted by a determined minority and supermajority cloture necessary to end those filibusters has given the Senate an enormous political influence at home and abroad. It has granted senators extraordinary powers, for good or for ill, as every senator learns very quickly. For the first 128 years of the Senate's existence, its members regularly blocked efforts to adopt a cloture rule. The early Senate, to be sure, for 17 years, did have a so-called previous question rule. But that rule was used infrequently and only to end debate on delicate, personally sensitive matters best left undiscussed. It was not used to end debate in order to vote on a pending measure. In 1917, under wartime duress, the Senate adopted its first genuine cloture rule. Over the next 45 years, until 1962, it conducted numerous filibusters, but invoked cloture just 5 times. Times have changed, of course, and this profoundly conservative institution has slowly adopted to those changes. The Senate adjusted its cloture rule in the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1970s, 1980s, and, of course, may choose to do so again. Such an action would bring to mind the late parliamentarian Floyd Riddick's frequently expressed opinion of Senate rules. A paraphrase of his position would be that the current 60-vote cloture rule is perfect. He had thought the previous 67-vote rule was also perfect. And if a future Senate, in its collective wisdom, changes that rule to a 51-vote majority cloture, maybe it would fall under some definition of perfect. Perfect or not, the adoption of majority cloture would surely mark the start of a major new chapter in the Senate's history. Now, more briefly, here's my second assessment of a Senate strength, and that has to do with staffing and information resources available to the Senate at the member staff, the committee staff, and at the institutional support staff level. I've been on the Hill since 1969, starting off working for the Legislative Reference Service at the Library of Congress, and before my very eyes, I've seen an enormous strengthening and expansion of staff at CRS, within the Senate, GAO, The Congressional Budget Office, and even the Senate Library, one of the world's finest legislative reference libraries, sometimes an underlooked treasure, but a spectacular resource. The Office of Senate Legislative Counsel, also an unheralded group of attorneys with enormous expertise to keep things on track. The Appropriations Committee, with 150 staff members, with very little turnover every time the chairman changes, either within or between parties. So staff and information resources available to members. And finally, very briefly, a strength of constituency communications, unheard of, undreamed of, certainly in the 19th century and on up through the 1960s. The access of members, as we all know in this room, between members and their constituencies has never been faster, more open. That is not only a strength, of course, but also it presents certain weaknesses, perhaps, too. Now, for my three weaknesses, I would mention the presidential nominations, the glacial pace of managing those nominations, and you look at the forms that have to be filled out at all levels. This is something that sort of defies logic, and it certainly defies historical experience when, you know, it wasn't until it was well into the 20th century that Supreme Court nominations were acted upon the same day that they were received in the Senate, or maybe being a deliberative body, they'd wait a day or so. And, of course, we're at a far cry from that at this point. The second one would be the fragmentation of members' attention spans. Again, sort of conventional wisdom. Members are deluged with information. You ask a House member who moves to the Senate, what's the difference? And, you know, you hear something about drinking out of a fire hose. You know, people are coming at you from all different directions, to say nothing of the thousands of lobbyists, special interest lobbyists that Senator Wyden referred to. Nowadays, senators are expected to be experts on all policy issues, and they can't go home and come up short on not knowing about everything. There are opportunities for senators to get to know their colleagues, but basically, and this is my third point, that senators are more isolated from one another than ever. Again, part of the conventional wisdom. The larger staffs serve as barriers that surround them. Easy commutes back to the home states tend to isolate senators from their colleagues. Efforts to I did a count. An individual senator serves on three or four committees, and they have, as their colleagues on their committees, about half the Senate. So if you accept the premise that committee work is the best laboratory of friendship and coordination in the Senate, any senator ought to know pretty well 50 senators. But, of course, that's a lot of senators and very little time. And the Senate, each of the parties has its party caucus luncheons every Tuesday. Again, an opportunity to kind of let down your hair a little bit. The doors are closed, and to get to know one another a little bit better. And from time to time, recent leaders have experimented with evenings out on the town. Let's go to the Smithsonian, take over the Air and Space Museum, and just socialize Republicans and Democrats together. That helps. That for sure. But it's. I'd see that as a big challenge. Thank you.
I am probably in a minority in this room, but I have no problem with that. I'm now doing something I told myself I would never do, which is participate in writing a book. Much of the information that I received when I was in the parliamentarian's office, I felt was received under attorney-client privilege, and I thought it would be a breach of that to write about the things that I knew. But I have a very good friend who recently retired from the Senate, Richard Ehrenberg, who is now a professor at Brown University, and he actually suggested about 6 months ago that we combine our views on something that both of us think is very important. And the title of our book is Soul of the Senate, Defending the Filibuster. We both feel that, frankly, the filibuster in the Senate is essential to the Senate playing the role that it does. Why do I say that? Well, I think partly because I have seen the Senate work in spite of the filibuster. I mean, I came to the Senate in 1966. When I came to the Senate, the Democratic Party had 68 senators, and the Republican Party had 32. The leaders were Senator Mike Mansfield of Montana and Senator Everett Dirksen of Illinois. Senator Dirksen worked with Senator Mansfield on many issues, and the issues, frankly, that were tearing the country apart in 1966 were two big issues, civil rights and the Vietnam War. And both of those issues split the parties. They did not have party luncheons in 1966. I would have loved to have seen a party luncheon of the Democratic Party in 1966. What I remember is that below the parliamentarian's chair is a small table at which the staff of the Democratic Policy Committee sits. And Senator Richard Russell had a staffer. And then basically there were the other staffers who basically tried to shut out the staffer who was under Russell's protection from information. And I would hear kind of comments back and forth. The Senate's filibuster is frankly a recognition of the enormous power that individual senators have. I can remember in the parliamentarian's office having visits from people who worked for the Canadian Senate. And they were quite concerned about how the Canadian Senate could become more like the American Senate. And my advice always to them was, well, first you'll have to have a revolution, because the House of Commons in Canada is never going to give power to the Canadian Senate like the American Senate has. I mean, the American Senate is unique in being an upper body that I argue is more powerful than the U.S. House of Representatives. And one of the reasons that it is because of the filibuster. I remember well after the election of 1994, and I had a number of friends on the House side who were Democrats who regularly kind of dissed the U.S. Senate, and suddenly they were going to be in the minority. And suddenly they saw the great value of the United States Senate, because they knew what was going to happen. Yes, Newt Gingrich and his band of Republicans were going to pass all of these ideas, and they were going to go to that black hole known as the U.S. Senate, where many of them would never be seen again. And, of course, that's exactly what happened, and it's because of the strength of the Senate filibuster. I am not in favor of changing the filibuster rule. I am, frankly, not really worried that the filibuster rule has any reasonable chance of being changed. I'm very well aware that to invoke cloture on a rules change in the Senate requires not 60, but two-thirds. And I think the chances of getting a two-thirds vote to change the filibuster rule, either in this session or in the next session, are minimal. So while I realize that probably in this room I'm in an extreme minority, because I think there's probably a general feeling that somehow the Senate is dysfunctional. I don't think the Senate is dysfunctional. I think the Senate is doing what it's supposed to do. And frankly, in light of the things that have passed, it has shown itself to be amazingly functional. It has done some very big things in this Congress. I think it will continue to do some very big things. and it doesn't need to change its rules to do them. That's my point.
Thank you for having me. Dick was the historian, the first one. He started the office. Bob was the parliamentarian for many years. I was just the staff guy that sat in front of Bob and pestered him with about 100 questions a day and made my living that way. But I think what you're seeing here is a good example of the Stockholm syndrome amongst all of us, because I'm pretty much with Bob on this. And I'm pretty much with Bob on this as far as changing the rules, and I'll get into that in a few moments. I mean, as Bob indicated, 94 and 93, Mitchell was leader. We were in the majority. And, you know, we would work with our House counterparts, and they would always complain about, you know, we're sending you all these bills, and nothing's happening with them. Sound familiar? And you're hearing that complaint today. And then, oh, lo and behold, the election in 94 comes along, and the first call we get that next morning is from the Democratic leadership staff saying, thank God you can still filibuster over there, because we're not going to be able to stop anything. We're counting on you to stop all of this. And we had gone into the minority, and we lost it too. But we still had 47 following the election. Eventually, those numbers changed, but we still had more than 41 to filibuster if we had to. It's a unique body. I mean, it's changed over the years, as Dick has mentioned. You didn't have cloture for many years. You had 1917, they put it in. It was rarely used. It's been used more. I mean, the place has changed in the sense that one of the biggest changes, I think, were as a result of air conditioning and jet travel, because that way members didn't have to stay in town. Gerald Ford died. You had his funeral. He lied in state. You watched that cortege drove through the city. Well, it drove through, I think it was Alexandria, where he lived. That's where he lived. That's where he raised his children. Nobody back in that state complained about him having a house here and sending his kids to school here. You know, he was a very popular guy. You don't see that now. You see these people looking at Washington as Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, they leave their family at home. They commute. They, I think there's 40 members of Congress that live in their offices. And as a result, you don't have the cross-pollination that you had when members knew each other. At least in the Senate, these guys used to commute with each other. I mean, Muskie used to ride in with Stevens. You know, one morning he got really mad at him when Muskie ignored something he wanted. You know, he told him he had an amendment on, and he ignored him on that. And then Mansfield came out and bailed him out. But these people would come in. They would recommend realtors and schools and where to go live and where to put your kids. And then they were on PTAs together, et cetera. You don't see that. And as a result, they got to know each other as people. And it's a lot tougher to be an enemy of somebody when you know them as a person and you went to the same PTA. You know, as I'm sure others have said it, I know Dolan O'Neill probably have said it, best, that, you know, your political opponent doesn't have to be your enemy. But when you don't know each other that well, it's so much, the partisan breakdown is so skewed. With this instant instant information, BlackBerries, the Internet, it's so easy. And the demands to raise money, and you have to constantly put out missives to your supporters, nationwide to try to raise money. It's absurd. It's obscene. The only thing that was worse was when they could collect honoraria. And then we had to, hold up the schedule so that they could run downtown and give a speech and come back. I mean, it was, thank goodness we got rid of that. But, the place does function. I mean, I'll tell you who's concerned about it functioning right now is a lot of banking lobbyists, because you've got a reg reform bill that's working its way through the Senate. Lo and behold, they're voting on amendments, and they're changing it, and eventually I think that's going to pass. And we'll see what happens once they put the two together with the House product. But, it is functioning. What before you go and want to change the rules, I think you ought to use the ones you've got to better advantage. And, maybe some radical things like having votes on a Monday morning or on a Friday afternoon. And you saw this in how health care was finally done in December, using the clock 24/7. They had to, and they did, and that bill got done. whether you liked it or not, it got done. And, you know, but that was a rarity, let's face it, and, you know, for an extreme situation. But, you know, every time in the last 2 months that Reed has threatened to stay in that night, having invoked cloture, and not just go out and say, okay, the 30 hours expires tomorrow at 6, so we'll have the vote tomorrow. Every time behind the scenes they've said, no, we're going to stay in tonight, and you have to have someone here to talk or to sit in a quorum, because Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was a movie. You can't force people to speak in a filibuster. You can force them to ruin, you can ruin their night and make them sit out on the floor and read their mail and put in a quorum call occasionally, but you can't force them to speak. And that's what, over the years, it had evolved to. And so it became easier to say, well, rather than have somebody sit out here and then have to have a presider and the police and the doorkeepers, who didn't want to stay all night either, you would say, okay, when's the clock run out? We'll have the vote tomorrow at 6. But every time in the past couple of months, when the Democrats have said, no, we're going to stay, all of a sudden they've gotten a better agreement of moving that vote up. And so, you know, if you eventually, if they're going to probably do it, and, you know, if they have to do it. I mean, I was a proponent, quite frankly, of starting it at the get-go on the motion to proceed, not even before cloture was invoked. You know, because I was, you know, sometimes off the charts on some of these things. But, you know, they would listen to me and say, okay, go away now. And, but, I mean, if you made them stay to debate the motion to proceed and say, okay, fine, you got to stay on the floor or we're going to put the question, and you had to wait the 2 days for cloture because you file on a Monday, your cloture vote's Wednesday. If you started doing that, granted they would have help, whoever is the person. You know, like Bunning even got some help that one time on unemployment. But after a while, that's going to grow old with people, you know, saying, I don't feel like being here at 3 o'clock in the morning just so you can go take a nap when you're the one holding this bill up. And so, I mean, if I think if they want to look at using the rules they've got, but it's admittedly a difficult task because it's an election year. You've got a large group of members on both sides of the aisle up for re-election. And, you know, they have to campaign. And so you have to pick and choose your moments to do that. And, you know, I'll just leave it at that. You know, I had two sets of cards when I was there, when I was the Democratic secretary, one set secretary for the majority, one set secretary for the minority. It just depended on the election. You know, so I knew how to build a bridge, and I knew how to blow it up. And I was perfectly content on either role. And my counterpart was the same. And we got along just fine. And, you know, and that, but that's the way the place is supposed to function. It's not supposed to be something that you run things through quickly. I mean, you can change the rules, but as Bob said, it takes two-thirds to invoke cloture and a rules change. I'm sure somebody already mentioned this when Wyden was here, about, you know, the Federalist Papers and, you know, only majority, you know, having the vice president break a tie and not mentioning, you know, two-thirds votes or supermajority votes in the Constitution only for certain things, et cetera. And so you've got what is called this constitutional option that people have said, well, they should be able to change their rules at the beginning of each Congress by majority vote. And this has been raised over the years. Well, eventually, it got to the point where LBJ was making a change, and in order to make the change, he had to put in the rules that the rules of the Senate shall continue from one Congress to the next Congress unless they are changed as provided in these rules. So if you were going to use this constitutional option, you're going to do it in violation of your own rules. And, you know, if that's what you want to do, so be it. I mean, you know, times change, you know. But if you're going to do that, you should be prepared for the Pandora's box that you're opening, because you're not always going to be in the majority, whoever chooses to do this, and you're not always going to have the White House. And so the next 2 years, say someone else takes over, well, if I'm them and you've rolled this tank over my back, then I'm going to say, okay, from now on, whatever bill comes up, the time limits on that bill will be decided by the Rules Committee, and for any nomination, the same. So what you will have done then is turn the Senate into a smaller version of the House, and you will have taken away vast amount of power from the individual member. If that's the road you want to go, be my guest. You know, I can deal with it either way, but I think it would be a big mistake. And I'll leave it at that.
Well, let me use the privilege of chairing this session to ask two questions. There were two themes that I heard from these comments. One theme was that the Senate does have problems, but some of these problems are rooted in other developments in American politics over the last several decades. The depersonalization due to trips home, the polarization of the parties, and so on is much of what the Senate struggles with. And so let me just ask, if it's true that modern life has fundamentally altered the nature of representation in American politics and the role that a senator plays, because constituents expect the senator to be home. Senators have demands on them related to gaining a re-election, and the Supreme Court's not likely to make it any easier. And if this is a fundamental change in our politics, shouldn't the rules of the Senate be adjusted to accommodate that new reality? Let me just ask that question.
You could start with the 1840s and say in the 1840s, people were talking about fundamental changes in American life. The transportation revolution, railroads, the communications revolution, the fact that Samuel Morse demonstrated his telegraph in the Capitol on the Senate side, and from that point on, members were able to know that they, when they gave a speech, that it would be in their hometown newspaper the next day because of new technological developments with high-speed printing press, steam-powered printing presses. So all of a sudden, members begin to look not to each other in their debates, but up to that press gallery. And at the time, a lot of discussion about we're moving into a new age. That's just one of many examples. So the strength of the Senate is that indeed it has been able to absorb and to adjust these changes over the years. And any examination of the rules of the Senate, all of them, it's a wonderful mirror to the changes in American society.
Bob or Marty?
Go ahead, Bob. You talk about fundamental change. I teach a course about congressional leadership. I use as a text Congress and its members. And the thesis of that text is that there are two Congresses, the one here in Washington, but the other one at home. And in light of the fact that there's going to be a contentious primary in Arkansas tomorrow, I'm reminded of another contentious primary in Arkansas, because when I came to the Senate, there was a senator from Arkansas named William Fulbright, who was seen on the Hill as a kind of a demigod, an incredibly powerful person. But it seems that he also forgot the people back home in Arkansas, and when a governor by the name of Dale Bumpers challenged him in the primary, he beat him. That has not changed. Yes, what happens here in Washington is important to members, but what is happening back home is equally important, and you forget about that at your peril.
I think it's interesting to look at the membership over the years. I mean, in the past just 4 years, you've got a huge influx of new members. And so change does come. You don't need term limits. I mean, you know, you've had a huge turnover. And often when you have turnover, though, you'll have new members come in, particularly if they're former House members. Well, House members, it's sort of mixed. I mean, they're happy as clams to be able to speak as long as I can. You know, I mean, you know, you mean I don't have to just limit this to 1 minute. But they're extremely frustrated when they see the lack of certainty in the schedule. You know, they don't know that the votes are going to be this, this, and this on Tuesday and Wednesday. So that's, they get frustrated. Former governors really get frustrated because they're used to, you know, their word being law. They walk in there and they find out they're low on the totem pole. But the place is meant to, and over the years, they get used to the pace of the Senate. And it's not meant to be something that moves quickly. Now, members being wanted to be home, with the technology today and the instant news, I think a lot of that could be done by you stay here and get your information home. You know, I mean, you can, you know, send out all sorts of information on your website. You can stay in touch with your people. The key is your constituent service. Thurman was famous for that. You know, Proxmire, good grief. I don't know if Proxmire ever raised a nickel in campaign finance, but he kept getting reelected. And so, you know, you can do it. You don't have to always be running around, you know, back home every weekend. You know, you could stay. You know, they could change the schedule and work some more time and use the technology to stay in touch with their people and to provide proper constituent service. And then maybe see if the rules that they have, I mean, they have changed over the years. I mean, it used to be 100 hours post-closure. Now it's 30. You know, it used to be two-thirds for everything. I mean, they've changed over the years, and I'm sure it'll change again. I just think if you're going to change it, you want to do it in the proper fashion.
Well, let me ask a second question. Another theme was that the supermajority cloture rule makes the Senate more powerful. And I'm wondering about that. Does it make the Senate more powerful or simply the 60th senator more powerful? Wouldn't the 51st senator or the 55th senator be more powerful if the cloture threshold was lower? What is there about negotiating these larger than simple majority coalitions that makes the Senate more powerful? Could you defend the claim that it makes the Senate more powerful?
Well, it certainly makes individual senators more powerful, which, in my view, is why they come to the Senate. You don't see a lot of transference from the Senate to the House. You see all the direction the other way. And I remember a conversation I had with a conservative Republican senator who was presiding over the Senate, and there are lots of down times in the Senate, so he just wanted to converse. And he was telling me that when he had been in the House, he had never spoken to any member of the Democratic Party in the House. They were irrelevant to his life. They couldn't do anything for him. They had no role. And suddenly in the Senate, he discovered that if you're going to get something done, you need to find somebody on the other side of the aisle who is as far from you philosophically as possible, but agrees with you on the particular issue that you care about. I saw this, for example, with the partnership between Senator Pete Domenici and Senator Wellstone on the issue of mental health parity for insurance. What brought them together? Well, it was personal experience. So that you have a situation in which, one, individual senators are much more powerful because of the filibuster rule, and also you have this kind of enforced coming together of senators who may not agree on 90% of all issues, but they'll find something on which they can agree. And it happens over and over and over again. I can remember Senators Edward Kennedy and Strom Thurmond getting together on the issue of whether members should be allowed to charge first-class airfare. And that just happened to be something that they agreed on, and so they had an amendment together. It happens over and over again, and I think the Senate is a better place because of it.
Any thoughts, Marty?
Yeah, I mean, clearly the members, the 60-vote threshold does make the Senate a different body versus the House, and it drives the House members crazy, especially when they have to negotiate, you know, an end product. They know that what they have to negotiate is something that can get 60 in the Senate, and whether it's done through conference or amendments between houses doesn't matter. I mean, they say that, well, we want some real conferences. No, that'll change things. It won't. They'll just have to come up with a conference report that has to get 60. But, you know, and having 60 at the outset of this Congress, it was more of a curse than a blessing. I mean, because if you start off in the minority with a smaller majority, then you know you've got to reach out and have a bipartisan product to try to get something done. Just having the 60 and not being able to get anything done through negotiations, then you were forced to try to keep that 60 together. And, you know, a lot of times it looked like the old monolithic Soviet bloc, which, you know, we know wasn't that monolithic. And it drove Senator Reid crazy trying to keep herd the cats and keep everybody on board. But, you know, it's clearly it's more powerful, but it was, I think, having only a third of the body up for each election, having an older age group to be members. I mean, I think that was one of the reasons, you know, they wanted a body that was a continuing body that was going to make it more difficult for things to get through in the outset.
Dick, any thoughts on that?
Well, only the unpredictability of the Senate as compared to the House. In unpredictability lies an element of power. You just don't know where it's headed, and you need to pay particular attention. And senators can give speeches, and those speeches are read very carefully because they're read between the lines as to what's really going to happen down the road. So I think that's an element of power.
Thanks. Questions from the floor? Sir?
Hi, Jim Moody. I serve in the House, so I'm obviously prejudiced on this topic. You know, as I understand it, the founders created the two legislative branch, two bodies, equal in power. They have different functions, organized differently, but equal in power. There's no presumption that one is more powerful than the other. Yet the defense of the Senate rules has given, this gives the Senate more power, this gives the Senate more power, and this gives the Senate more power. Seems to me that seems to be a diversion from what the Founding Fathers wanted it to be. When the House is told, you either accept this or forget it, we're not going to pass it because if we change one thing here, the whole bill's dead. That is a huge drain of power away from the House to the Senate. I really question that that's how the system is supposed to be.
Let me defenders of the Senate. I talk about this issue in my classes, and I do not pretend to be objective. I explained that I worked only for the United States Senate, that I had never worked for the House of Representatives, and that I never really wanted to work for the House of Representatives. Because to me, the House of Representatives is the great disappointment of American democracy. It has been so careless of its powers. I mean, it is given a huge power, the revenue power. Only the House can originate revenue bills. And what has it done with that power? It has frittered it away by allowing the Senate on repeated occasions to take some minor little House revenue bill and offer a huge tax bill, and then the House either takes it. To me, the most extraordinary time was in the early 80s when a bill that was going to cut revenue had a Dole amendment that was going to raise revenue by a huge amount, and the House went to conference on the Senate amendment. Didn't even offer an amendment on the House floor to change it. Could argue that maybe the Founding Fathers meant for the two bodies to be equal in power, but the result has not been an equality in power, and I lay that right at the feet of the House in the way that it's treated its powers.
The House was furious in 1795 about all of the attention the Senate was getting in consenting to ratification of Jay's Treaty. And they said, well, after all, we have the appropriations power, and we're gonna basically have our checkmate on the decisions that are underwritten by that treaty in terms of what we'll appropriate and what we won't. It was, you know, the sort of the second sitting of the Constitutional Convention. There were a lot of people around at that point that had been in Philadelphia, and the House backed off, and probably wisely so. So I would just say that there's sure the power is equal. But because the Senate was small, because it was viewed as a sort of like a governor's council, it had the unique responsibilities of advice and consent. And we will stay tuned for the future Supreme Court nomination hearings to see where all of the attention goes as a result of that particular constitutional responsibility.
All I can say is from a leadership staff standpoint, we used to look at the House wistfully and with awe and at what you could do by majority vote. You know, I mean, you had the Rules Committee. You could just do wonders. I mean, you could have votes on things that would say that, you know, by voting on this, then the conference report is deemed now changed and send it over to us. And it's like, we would just sit there and say, wow. You know, I mean, maybe you died. Maybe the House didn't, you know, would chafe and feel like that they didn't have as much power, but we were always amazed at how much you could get done with that Rules Committee. And Trent Lott, when he was majority leader, used to constantly complain to me about how I wish I had a rules committee, you know, because then I wouldn't need to talk to you. There are some issues where, you know, the 60 votes does come into play, but, the ability to originate revenues, et cetera, and blue slip our bills, you know, it is a huge power. But, you know, it's just a matter of how you look at it.
Ross?
You're the only Ross I can see in the...
You're not the only Baker.
That's true.
Ross Baker from Rutgers University. I wonder if you feel the same way about the hold as you do about the filibuster, in the sense that you sort of made the case that the filibuster pretty well defines what the Senate is. Would you also say that for the hold and the secret hold as well?
The hold does have a use. Senator Coburn has referred to the McCarthyite use of the hotline. Well, you wonder what the heck is a hotline? The Senate not having a rules committee, a lot of the stuff is done by unanimous consent, and it takes time to get everyone to agree to pass this bill, whether it's National Peach Week to a wilderness bill that someone's been trying for decades to get done, or land exchange, who knows what. But these things are worked out with the majority-minority staffs. Members will consult with the leadership and say, if this bill comes up, they'll send them a note. We used to call them consults, not holds. I want to be consulted if this bill comes up. I may have an amendment. If the effort works its way through the process, the committee says we want to try to pass it with this amendment, we would let them know, the member who notified us, that, yes, you know, they're trying to move this. You should talk to them if you have an amendment. It gets to the point where they've got it all, anyone that's consulted with them, they have it to the point where both sides think they can pass it. And we run it on what is called the hotline. The Republicans have one. We have one. The Democrats have one. And it's a notice that goes out, and the staffer says, you know, the majority leader has a request to pass this bill. It gives the title and the bill number with a manager's amendment or with a new committee substitute and with an amendment by Senator Coburn. So if your senator has any objection, please notify the cloakroom. By the end of the day, if nobody's called, then that bill will be done by whoever's filling in for the leader. And this works for nominations, too. It's at that hotline stage where someone who is not on the committee did not think that, you know, as Bill, Dick said, you know, some of these guys are on 5 and 6 committees, women and guys. You can't always keep track of everything. And so the stuff that the committees you're not on, all of a sudden this hotline comes out, and some staffer realizes in your office that heard the hotline, they pass it up to the ledge director, and he gets it to the appropriate person. And they say, wait a minute, this may affect our state. You know, I want to consult with the people back home and find out before we let this go. So they'll call a cloakroom and say, yo, would you snag it for us? We want to look into it. That's a confidential snag. We'll give them time to get their information. Now, you say, well, they shouldn't have the, you know, but at some point, I think they should have at least a couple of days. You can argue about the length of time. Right now, it's 6 days, but, you know, in that calendar, where they can get information and decide whether they want to continue with the snag or whether they want to try to amend or what have you. And they should be able to have that right, in my opinion, to do that without being attacked by all the groups downtown and say, well, you've got a hold on this bill. Why are you holding up this bill? I think they're entitled to some time where they can do their own research without having to be attacked. Eventually, especially if it's something where they want to amend, that information comes out because they call the committee, and the committee then knows. I mean, the place is a village. I mean, there's very little up there that you don't know about. With a nomination, usually if someone's holding it, it's because they want to get something for it, or they want someone else to be, say, it's a board or commission. They're waiting for the Republican or the Democrat, you know, counterpart that's going to also be appointed to that commission, or they're trying to get some piece of legislative leverage out of somebody. I mean, eventually, you know, your hold does you no good if it's a secret hold, because then you've lost, you know, what leverage? What are you trying to do? Now, granted, there are times where you will have somebody who's just so mad at someone that he held up his bill They say, I'm going to hold up anything this person wants. Well, that's human nature, you know, but eventually that passes too. So, I mean, in my opinion, the hold has its, you know, or consult, and the hold is only as good as long as the majority leader doesn't call up the bill or the nomination. I mean, granted, he doesn't have time to act on every one of these, which is why you've got a lot of nominations sitting on that calendar right now. But, you know, we had Democratic leaders tell me to go tell that senator that I'm going to the bill tomorrow anyway, even though he's got a hold on it. You know, and you'd have to tell him, look, you know, the bill's got a coming up tomorrow. If you want to speak on it, if you want to try to slow it down, you need to be on the floor. You know, your hold is only as good. We used to advise staff that their hold is only as good as long as they could deliver a body onto the floor to debate the motion to proceed or to filibuster the nomination. You know, and if they can't, it's amazing how many holds disappear at, you know, 1 o'clock on a Friday morning in a late night session. And, you know, when they're told that, well, I'm going to call this up now, do you want to object? And, you know, they say, that's all right, let it go. And so I think members should have at least some time, in answer to your question, to do research on something that may affect their state without being attacked downtown, without their names being bandied about. But I don't think that they necessarily deserve it forever. But I think in a vast majority of those situations, they don't get secrecy forever, because if they're looking to negotiate something, the committee knows it, and the committee shares information across the aisle, and they tell the leaders, and somehow it gets out.
Yes, back there.
Pete Chutley from Brookings. You've made a good case that one of the benefits of the Senate's working is the protection of minority rights. I'd like to put a second criteria for functionality, which is, does it do the job in terms of making public policy decisions on time? If the executive branch, let's say two agencies in the executive branch, simply fail to agree and no decision were made on hot current issues, the country would be outraged, saying, we want an answer. If you personally in your family life didn't, you know, renew your insurance or your driver's license or whatever because you couldn't reach some kind of agreement, people would be outraged. There are all kinds of policy issues on which no action is taken that are highly urgent. 200-some treaties in line in the queue in the Senate. 90-some nominations. That's another measure of functionality, and I would say by that measurement, the Senate fails. Lots of public policy decisions aren't being made, and companies can't act, states can't respond, federal government can't respond because the Senate won't act. So by that measure, I think the Senate would fail.
You're basically arguing for more efficiency in the Senate. Would you say the Senate should be more efficient than it is?
In some ways, yes.
The noun Senate and the word efficiency never seem to live too well together in the same sentence. It's what makes the hair stand up on the back of people like you and people who work in the Senate. When we start thinking about the Senate being made more efficient, I think of the reforms right after World War II, Robert La Follette Jr. And George Galloway wanted to make the Senate more efficient. Let's have joint House and Senate committee hearings, a proposal that's still very much alive today, because it will save time and be more efficient. It just seems to be it's so alien to the culture of the institution. It is so, to use the common expression, embedded in the DNA, and the consequences are just what you explained, and it's lamentable, but I don't know where you go from there.
So. Can I break in on that? Efficiency, one of those value-laden words. Who could be against efficiency? Well, I'm against efficiency for this reason. The Senate can make two mistakes. It can pass bad legislation, and it can fail to pass good legislation. And the closer it gets to avoiding the one kind of mistake, the farther it gets from avoiding the other. The Senate was designed to be the place that slowed down those wonderful ideas from the House that they send over by the bushel, they are an incredibly efficient legislative body. But I think that's why the Senate is there. And if you destroy its ability to stop bad legislation, then you'll see a lot of stuff go through that maybe will surprise or maybe appall you.
Back here in the far back. Go ahead.
Red tie?
Yeah. That's...
Thank you very much for the enlightenment so far. Kent Watkins, I once was with Senator Carl Hayden, and he called me in. I was the legislative director, and he said, I want you to go and be the staff director of the Standing Rules Subcommittee, because I want you to make sure that no changes are made. And you're supposed to just talk with Doc Riddick every day and hold the fort against Senator Clark and others. So I did that, but he was also then the President Pro Tem, Chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Chairman of the Patronage Committee, and Acting Vice President. So he had a number of bases covered where even as Vice President he wasn't going to rule in favor of anything. So my question is, however, despite that position, a number of things that your paper said points to some changes that have been made that are not comprehensive, but through reconciliation bills and the Budget Act and so forth, certainly are some incremental strategies that have occurred that keep this cap off the volcano or the geyser from exploding, if that were to happen anyway. So my main question is, from the three of you or four of you, is do you foresee any more changes or what kind of an agenda of incrementalism as opposed to trying to work on the over comprehensive change at the beginning of Congress that might happen or could happen, but without unanticipated consequences, such as hurting the committee hearing system, which some of these reforms have done, in my opinion, or some other kinds of unanticipated consequences? Thank you.
So are there reforms you would like to see related to the filibuster and Rule 22? Bob?
I'd like to respond now knowing that you worked for Carl Hayden, because Carl Hayden was the president pro tem when I came to the Senate, and I remember talking with him about his views on the filibuster, and his views were that if it hadn't been for the filibuster, there wouldn't have been an Arizona. That's what stopped the admission.
What's the bad news?
Well, as somebody has recently said, we are all Arizonans now.
Well, de-statehood was not one of the solutions that I had in mind for filibuster reform or Senate reform, but, you know, that's a. I'll put that down. Marty or Dick, you want to take on the reform question?
I'm not going to recommend any reforms, but, you know, the place does change in its operation, not just through rules change. I mean, Bob, remember, you used to be able to filibuster the motion to proceed to a nomination. You can't, Senator, anymore. Senator Byrd, through a precedent, setting, at vote on the floor, over, established that it's non-debatable now to move to anything on the executive calendar. We had instances where the chair was overturned throughout the legislation on appropriations rule and on a scope of conference rule. Two separate times the chair was overturned, thus throwing out the enforcement of those two rules for a number of years, of which they live to regret, and eventually Senator Lott came back and said, you know, like, how about if we put those back? And we ended up restoring them. But there are other ways of affecting how the place works, but in each of those cases, you had unintended consequences. You know, I mean, overturning the chair on legislation appropriations meant that the majority could offer anybody, and it's particularly meant more to the minority, could offer anything they wanted to an appropriations bill, authorizing language per se, and wouldn't have that to fight over a point of order. And after a number of years of that freedom, and for us it was huge because we were being blocked out of offering amendments on the floor to almost everything at the time. We'd call it up, fill the tree, file cloture. We vote against cloture, and they'd accuse us of filibustering. You know, there goes those obstructionists again. And so when they opened up that gaping hole in the appropriations rule, that was our only avenue to offer amendments. And after living with it for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, I think it was, they finally decided, you know, we want to go back to the way it was. And the same thing with scope of conference. I mean, each of those cases, though, had unintended consequences. And so, I mean, I couldn't rule out that something else like that could happen in the future, and then we'll see what the consequences are.
Dick, do you have any?
As a historian, I'm temperamentally incapable of predicting the future. Stay with me.
Okay. Well, actually, our time has expired. We'll have a chance for many more questions and answers at the end of the next session. Please join me in thanking these experts on the Senate.